Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, two great filmmakers and writer-directors will speak with Ash Mayfair about her new film, The Third Wife, and Jessica Scalise on her horror comedy, Zilla and Zoe. That's all coming up on Endeavors. My first guest is writer-director Ash Mayfair. Ash was getting her MFA in filmmaking from NYU when she first wrote the script for The Third Wife, which in 2014 won the Spike Lee Production Fund. Inspired by family histories, mainly those of her great-grandmother and grandmother, as well as numerous other stories in Vietnam, The Third Wife is a coming-of-age story about a child forced to grow into a woman and the consequences of her self-discovery. Set in 19th century Vietnam, May is 14 years old and given away in an arranged marriage to become the third wife of a much older man. The film explores the heroine's journey to achieve personal freedom, even though the price may cost May her life. She did a casting search far and wide for the young heroine, eventually settling on 12-year-old Tra Mi Nguyen. The film played at TIFF in 2018. And is opening up in theaters in select cities next week. This is my conversation with Ash Mayfair. Ash Mayfair, hello. Welcome. Thanks for being here today.
Well, thank you, Dan McPeak. Thank you for making time for me.
So you have your film out, The Third Wife, and I know that in part this film was inspired by family stories, like your great grandmother and your grandmother.
That's right. Yeah.
What made you decide to want to turn that family history, if you will, into this story of May?
It's not just the family history individually, but it's you know, there's the entire culture that came with it. And the story of women who lived in that period. And I'm always interested in womanhood as a theme, as a subject. I grew up with these women. There's not a single woman you can see in this film that is not based on somebody I know and love very dearly. So my whole life, I've grown up around them, and you know, the story has changed. Like, at some point I thought it was going to be a novel, at some point I wanted to create a play, maybe an opera, and then at NYU, in my final year of film school, I was encouraged to write a screenplay, so that's where it started.
And I know was it true that the screenplay won the Spike Lee Award or something like that?
Yes.
Once you won that, and I know you got a couple other of awards for it, how real did the project seem, and how real did it become?
You know, it was unreal right until the moment we started shooting. I was a nobody, and the budget is substantial for a Vietnamese film. It's a period piece. I never would have imagined that all the elements came together as they did, even though it took a long time. This is my fifth year now working on the project, and it took like 3 years, a little bit longer than that, to gather everything together. But I was pinching myself, like, up until the first day of shooting, because really, frankly, I couldn't believe it.
Now, this film does deal with arranged marriages. Obviously, it takes place in 19th century Vietnam. But we hear a lot of stories today about arranged marriages, you know, India, Pakistan, a lot in Arab countries in the Middle East. But how prevalent is it still in Vietnam and in other sort of Southeast Asian countries and that culture?
I think it hasn't gone away completely. I think arranged marriages and polygamy have been outlawed. Certainly in the 20th century, it's no longer legal. However, it still happens, and what is more damaging, I think, is the residual ideology that came with it, because it wasn't just arranged marriages for underage young girls. You know, it was also young boys. And now in the modern Vietnamese society, there's still quite a heavy submission, so to speak, to the authority of the forefathers, to the idea of an equitable match, to all that. And tradition prevails in many cases. So I would say in the far-flung corners of the country, smaller villages, probably the practice still exists, yeah.
You know, just on that note, there's a great line that the old man says in the film where he says, "We are but dust
in the shadow of the Buddha."
You know, in regards to our previous question, and also, you know, about the overall story and the culture, how much does faith and spirituality come into it at all?
Hugely. Because the Buddhism that existed in 19th century Vietnam and is somewhat today too, is a combination between Confucianism, inherited from northern Vietnam, coming from China, and a particular sect of Buddhism that like celebrates karma and reincarnation. So you see that the cycle of life is quite prevalent in the film. You see that prayer is quite prevalent in the film, the idea that a prayer can affect, you know, someone to have a miscarriage is really strongly believed. And it mixed with this kind of atmosphere of animism too, surrounding that, of a lot of superstitious tales, old wives' tales, so to speak, told by the older servants, and believe in ghosts and this kind of thing. Is I think spirituality and faith in the unknown really did inform the way people lived their everyday lives is affected by it.
You mentioned that you always like to explore womanhood in your stories, and of course one of the most, I think, powerful images or metaphors that I saw in this film was the use of blood, whether it's literal or metaphorical. And it strikes me almost, especially at the end when I was watching May, that I saw a tie, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, between blood and the liberation of women. What were you trying to say, if anything specific, by using that imagery a lot?
I think blood is a beautiful thing. In terms of just the image itself, it's rich, it's life-giving. It literally is life. It's water, which is in the large part tied to nature. So for me, water and blood and life are really much the same thing. It's the flow through life. It also denotes purity or loss thereof. After her wedding night, that's what we see, the sign of blood. When the older daughter or the second wife has her first blood, we experience that because we know she's coming of age and will therefore start her very journey that's similar to what May is experiencing. It's to do with childbirth. I think it's a powerful and absolutely humane concept too, because it's in all of our veins.
Speaking of young girls, I know you went through over, I think, was it 900 young women to find the role of May, and you landed on Trami, or is it Trami or Tramai?
Well, your pronunciation is excellent. I am astounded.
Trami, thank you. But I heard that you almost didn't get her because initially her mother was a bit disapproving or maybe not altogether willing for her to take the role. But what was the overall process like for going through all these castings and finding her? And what was it about Trami that that really stuck with you?
So casting itself, I think took me, just for that role, took me around 8 months. And I traveled literally to every single school in the country. I knew that I wanted an Uncle Nguyen. I didn't want someone with, you know, a lot of exposure to the industry already. Because in Vietnam, there's no agency or actors network, so to speak, to rely on. When I found her, actually, I casted her maybe a total of 3 times, and she came in to audition for a different role, for the role of the bride of the son, the new bride. But I knew that she was different just from the way she looked at me. And so I had her read for the part of May. You know, her name was already so similar to the character, so it kind of struck me. And after she talked to me and told me about how she felt about her mother, her family, I decided that she was it. But when I sent the family the script and the actress too, you know, it was Trami who convinced her mother and also convinced me in the process, because she was still at school and I was aware that we'd have to make a lot of concessions in terms of shoot hours. So that every day after shoot, she'll come back, she'll get tutored by a teacher, and she'll still have her exams, like, through the whole year of prep. But yeah, that role could not have been played by anyone else.
You know, I know she was only 12 when you found her, and given the nature of the role, there's the opening with the wedding night, and then her relationship with Mr. Swan. How did you go about discussing that with her and sort of making sure she was, you know, was comfortable, sort of understood everything that came with the role, especially since she was so young?
Well, with complete honesty. That's the only way you can do something like that. I gave her the entire script and her family, and we discussed this, you know, with her parents in tow, and I demanded that her parents or her guardian would be present every moment that we're shooting. And I also told her that the condition that I'll create for her to work comfortably during these kind of transitions, especially very sensitive and difficult scenes, you know, even for an adult to do, would be with the utmost care and respect. Like, I made sure there was a female DP for that reason. I made sure that the majority of the people staying, when we had to do intimate scenes, were women. But more than that, I think beyond it, Trami brought to me her idea of what it would be like first. And so it was very interesting to already see her understanding of the growth of the character itself, you know, before we went deeply into discussing the technicality of how the scene would be shot and so forth. She already understood what it would be like to act a child transitioning into a wife, a lover, a woman, eventually a mother.
Do you feel that the growth that we see of May's character was maybe paralleled by the growth that Trami was taking while making this film?
I'm sure all of us went through a huge developmental phase, you know, myself included. This is my first feature. So it's definitely part of the equation. And we spent a year together, minimum. Some of us way more. My cinematographer and I, for example, we've known each other since NYU. So, and by the end of this film, she became pregnant. So she was shooting for the last month of this production, pregnant. Like, all of this, I think, play a factor in how we've grown as artists and as people, for sure.
One thing that really struck me about Tra Me was she was so good at facial expressions and all, in having that very inward reaction, especially because I think I counted it was 9 minutes into the film before there was any real dialogue. What went into that decision to sort of open it in a very silent manner?
The script was always very bare bone to start off with anyway, because I knew that I wanted the film to feel very much coming from this perspective of this young girl, and because it was such an internal kind of development, like, as you say, the depth of her reaction, the observation she's making of the world is what will lead us as an audience into the story. So that was the principle behind it, behind keeping the film itself very silent, and the main character even more so.
What do you think? What do you think child actors, child performers, or children can, at least in your experience making this, can teach us or can teach you about storytelling?
This is a great question, man. I have to say I really enjoyed this interview so far. I was just complaining because I came from the Vietnamese premiere directly and landed at 2 a.m. this morning in New York. And I sat through, like, maybe, I don't know, 80 interviews now. But this is my favorite question so far.
Oh, thank you so much.
You know, so much of my work is about nostalgia and childhood. And it is because I keep trying to go back, at least to the way that I remember seeing, feeling, and experiencing the world. It's not just about that innocence, but it's also that openness and acceptance. I think children can teach us a lot, not just in production, in art, but also in life. And if we can harness that, you know, for lack of a better word, really, that transcendental, right? The kind of immediacy that children just naturally embodies, then we don't be very happy. And I would be a very satisfied kind of artist.
One of the things that I really, really loved about the film was the score. At times it was minimal, and at times it was just so beautiful, and I think so reminiscent of that period. How much did you work with the with your composer Ton Fatan to create the style that you wanted?
So it was actually quite amazing because I asked Anne to come and visit us on set, and on his first day of visit, we were shooting the scene where the two young girls were in bed singing a lullaby. You know, when Mae was already pregnant. That song was sung to me by my mother, and I was filming it, and I turned around, and Anne was, like, close to tears, and I asked him, what's wrong? He said, well, this song was sung to me by my mother. So immediately, there was a sort of connection that was almost, it was like it was meant to be, so to speak. And after that, it became fairly simple and direct to work with each other. I can tell you, though, that the process of editing the score, for example, and even assembling the score was not traditional in any way, because I edited the score with Anne and with my editor the way we assembled music, the picture itself, I'm sorry, the way we assembled the actual picture cut. So let me explain that. I can see you furrowing your brows. So typically, say the director would give a time code and say, I need music from this second to this second, give it to the composer, right? That's not how I work with Anne. I told him I want to be able to use the soundscape as if it's its own world and its own character. And in order to achieve this, I need to select the best of the best from everything that you have to offer in terms of this world. So he produced nearly 10 hours of music. From that 10 hours, we cut, edited, and assembled what we use in the film itself.
How much can music, and I think in your film as well, just the scenery, how much can that become another character in the story?
It already is. I think by scenery, I want to also be more specific, because what you see include nature and also man-made objects, right? The house, the boats, you know, in opposition to, say, the mountain, the caves, the rivers. They are parts of the world, and they belong to this one very singular landscape that is, I think, both 19th century, but also somewhat more transcendental and universal than that. It's man versus nature. The score worked in the same way. We started from the concept of man versus nature, or human versus nature, you want to be more, you know, gender equitable. And from there, and use a balance between, say, acoustic, natural instruments, woodwinds and strings, and this is more like mechanical, perhaps computer-generated sounds. You know, versus voices. We were always trying to kind of navigate that. So they definitely have their own very peculiar characteristics, yeah, the music and the background. So
there is, of course, a storyline in the film about young women desiring each other. And just curious as to what is the acceptance, I guess, like, of LGBTQ themed stories or LGBT culture, like in Vietnam and around Southeast Asia?
Right now?
Yeah.
I can only answer for Vietnam, because I think it's vastly different from, like, say, Cambodia or Myanmar or Thailand or Indonesia. I think now, within this past, like, decade or so, it's become more accepted and tolerated, both in the arts, you know, and in life. Like, when I was growing up, it was not an easy or public acknowledgement, so to speak, that the community exists. In fact, I just published an article on Talk House about this very thing this morning. If you Google my name in Talk House, you find it. Legally, there's no barrier, but there's also no protection for the community.
What do you think, you know, I think out here in the West and Western culture, in school, we learn certain things about Vietnam, about China, about Asia, but what do you think is the biggest misconception about Vietnam and about that culture today?
I really don't know. I mean, it's interesting because I'm Vietnamese, but I've also lived in Britain for a very long time, and I've also lived and worked in America for a very long time. So for me, the word Vietnam has a multitude of meanings that might be very different from, say, what Vietnam means to a Vietnamese refugee coming here in 75. That, again, will be very different from what Vietnam means for someone living in Vietnam their whole life. I wouldn't say is a misconception, so to speak, but I do find that the commonality of association that people think of when Vietnam is mentioned, first of all, is the war, and in particular, the Vietnamese-American War. And then second of all, is a fantastic tourist destination. Literally, you know, either if I meet someone new and they ask me where I'm from and I say Vietnam, the reaction usually falls into either of those categories. It's also one of the reasons why I make this film, because I think Vietnam as a country, as a nation, it's my birthplace, is richer than both of those narratives. It's much more humane, it's got a world of story and personalities, and it's also much more complex.
So the film, just to wrap up here, is not only a coming-of-age love story, but it's in a way it's also a love letter to Vietnam.
I love how you describe it, because that's how I've been saying it too. It's a love letter to Vietnam, but specifically to the north of Vietnam where my family came from. Well, now my second film will be a love letter to the south of Vietnam where I was born and where I grew up.
Well, we look forward to that film when it comes out. Finally, what do you want audiences to take away from this film when they see it?
I'm not sure if I have any control over what they'll take away. I hope dearly that everything I've created, everything that the team has put into the film, will touch people in some ways. And we will not be forgettable, because that probably is the artist's greatest nightmare. So I am totally fine if people hate it or love it. But if the reaction is middling, not good.
Yeah. The artist's worst fear is to always be irrelevant. The film is The Third Wife. I believe it opens nationwide this weekend.
Yes, it actually opens in New York tomorrow with like rolling open dates, 24th in LA, 30th in Texas, and several other, I think 30 other cinemas.
It's a very good film. I encourage all those who are listening, especially in the States, to go see it. Ash Mayfair, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you very much, Dan. Right. Fantastic interview.
Have a good day. That was my conversation with filmmaker Ash Mayfair, writer-director of the beautiful The Third Wife, and it's being released in theaters today. From 19th century Vietnam to modern-day Portland, Jessica Scalise's Zilla and Zoe is a horror comedy about a little girl and her love for all things that go splat. Her father, fed up with her ways, demands that if she wants to continue filmmaking, she must film her older sister's lesbian wedding. Keeping Portland weird, hilarity ensues in this comedy of errors in which follows this dysfunctional family around. This is my conversation with Jessica Scalise about Zilla and Zoe. Jessica Scalise, hello, welcome. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
So your film is Zilla and Zoe. I watched it. I laughed out loud a lot. I really enjoyed it. It strikes me that this is almost a bit of a send up of the horror genre. Do you consider that in any way?
what of the horror genre?
It's almost like a send up or a parody of the horror genre in certain aspects, I think.
Yeah, it's interesting. So it's about a little girl who's trying to make a horror film, and it's based on, I have so many friends who work in filmmaking and make horror films, so it's really, you know, influenced by that, but it's not a horror film itself. Right. It's more of a family comedy.
But what's really interesting to me is that while watching it, one film that immediately came to my mind that it reminded me of was The Birdcage.
I love that movie.
I'm just curious as to whether that was any sort of influence for this film at all.
The Birdcage with Robin Williams, right?
Yes, yes.
It wasn't a conscious influence, but I do really enjoy that movie. And I actually watched it recently, and I think it's a little bit ahead of its times in that it took a homosexual relationship, and even though it's a comedy, it took it seriously and showed a intimate, caring relationship in a way that a lot of people could understand and identify with. And that was definitely something that we tried to do in Zilla and Zoe. So perhaps I was influenced a bit by that. And we tried to make it, you know, funny, which The Birdcage is as well.
You mentioned that you sort of did this film as an homage to a lot of your friends that are in the horror genre. But I'm curious, as you know, as a filmmaker and as someone who has been interested in telling stories since a young age, do you see any of yourself in Zoe or vice versa?
Oh yeah, people always ask me that, and Zoe is a lot like me as a child, although she's not an exact copy. My family has requested that I make it clear that this is not a literal story about my family. But Zoe, the character, is similar to me. She's just obsessed with storytelling for no reason that she can really figure out. She was just born that way. And she's determined to get her movie made at all costs. And that's pretty much like me.
You know, both of you had an interest in storytelling at a young age. Have you thought about what attracts us to the interests that we have when we are children? You know, you're attracted to filmmaking, always attracted to horror. Where do you think those interests come from? Is that something you've thought about at all?
That's a really good question. I've thought about where our interests come from and where our personalities come from, but I really don't have a good answer. I've always had this intense interest in stories. I just like to be living in another story, making it up. And there's really nothing I can do about it. And it's been, you know, my parents did not really want me to be a filmmaker. And if I had thought about it logically, I wouldn't have wanted to be a filmmaker, but I just couldn't really control it. So I'm not really sure where that comes from, but it's mirrored in Zoe. And I think it's just something that you're born with.
You mentioned that you had a lot of friends, especially in the indie film community, that are in, you know, that are horror filmmakers. Do you consider yourself a fan of that genre?
I think I disappoint audiences when they ask me that in the Q&A after Zilla and Zoe, but no, I'm not a horror fan. I admire it. I think that it's really fun to work on the set of a horror film, but I'm a big wimp. I get too scared. So that's why I don't watch many horror films myself.
You know, I know you've also written a children's book as well. Why do you think children or young people make such good protagonists for stories? What is it about their point of view?
Well, I think children are more honest than adults, and they haven't learned, they're more interesting in a way because they haven't learned to cover up their thoughts, and so they see things clearly and they say what they think, and I think that's very interesting. I wish everybody did that. I wish I could just peer into people's minds as soon as I met them, because I'm so interested in people. But most people cover up their true personalities when you first meet them.
And I know along with the children's book, you've also written a bunch of short stories. Would you say your writing process changes a lot depending on the medium that you're using?
You mean the writing process, like...
Yeah, so like...
What time you write.
Well, or yeah, or just like, you know, your process for writing a film versus writing a short story or writing a children's book or whatever.
That's a good question. So I'm very interested in writing process because I think it strongly affects your writing. And I've pretty much discovered that no matter what I'm working on when I'm writing, I personally write best early in the morning. So I like to get up and just immediately start writing for about 4 hours, and that seems to be my kind of creative chunk of day. So whatever I'm working on, that's what I try to do. And then the process does change if you're writing a screenplay or a short story. I mean, there's a lot more outlining for a screenplay, and a short story I kind of tend to just see images and sort of write them down as I go.
And people might not know this, but I know when you were at Stanford, you actually double majored in writing in math. And I think for a lot of artists, math can be a foreign concept. How has having that background helped you, you know, as a filmmaker and a storyteller, whether it's sort of, you know, that balance between the left and right brain or being good with maybe the numbers and the business side of things? How has math, do you think, helped you as a writer, as a storyteller?
Well, studying math is really, to me, about problem solving and logical thinking. So most people, when they hear that I have a math background, they're really startled. But I think that being a film, not a film writer, but a film producer and sometimes a film director, especially on an indie film, it's just problem solving. That's all it is. Basically, you're doing something that seems impossible, and every single day you're going to have a million people tell you this thing went wrong, so now we know that what we're doing really is impossible. And every single time the answer is, it's not impossible, let's figure out a logical way to solve this problem. And you solve it. And you just have to know in advance that you are going to solve it and there is always a way. So that's what I like about math. I like the problem solving and the logic.
I know.
And
that,
in school, I always liked, yeah. I liked math better than English.
I know you set this film in Portland and you shot it there. And Portland is one of those cities that has a reputation, a certain reputation for good or for ill, but and there's a line in the film that I love that goes about keeping Portland weird. But what is it about that city that makes it such a great and unique setting, especially for this type of film?
I love Portland. I find it a really inspiring place for the art. I had been filmmaking in Los Angeles, and when I left, everybody told me, oh, you're never going to succeed as a filmmaker. This is where the industry is. But to me, Los Angeles, a lot of the filmmaking in LA has lost its interest in really good, genuine storytelling with a good story and interesting characters, and they're more focused on special effects or having a certain star or just, you know, doing whatever you need to make money. And I'm interested in telling a good story. And I think Portland as a city really, they're not interested in, you know, just making money and being successful. They really support the arts and they're interested in independent ventures. And I felt like making a film here, you really experience that. People are very supportive and very creative. And there are a lot of creative people who move here just because they enjoy the vibe of the city. So you can get them to work on your film, which is great. And then the city itself, I just love writing about it. It's full of creativity. And you can be sitting on the street and you'll see people walking by, you know, like a man in a tutu riding a unicycle, and that's just kind of fun. It just adds a little magic to life.
I know that I think Chuck Palahniuk described Portland as very neurotic. I know Fred Armisen talks about Portland, you know, as a sort of like great hipster craft brewery city. Why do you think Portland has the reputation that it does, particularly from those who are outside it?
Good question. I'm not exactly sure. You know, everyone has a slightly different view of what Portland is, but I see it as a place with, you know, there are a lot of hipsters, a lot of weird people, and the kind of town slogan is "Keep Portland Weird." That's, you know, there's a bumper sticker that says that, and we use that in the movie. And so if the reputation is that Portland is weird, I think that's because people here celebrate their differences and kind of embrace who they really are. You know, no one, people make a goal of finding out what's weird and unique about them and embracing that instead of trying to conform to some normal kind of thing. And as someone with a lot of internal weirdness, I really appreciate that.
I want to say I really loved Ada's performance in the film. I thought she had really good facial expressions, which is rare for a child actor. What was the process like for you in finding her and Holden to portray these kids?
Well, we had Cast Iron Studios, which is the big Northwest casting agency, took on our film, which was really nice of them because we're kind of smaller a smaller project than they usually work with. And so they sent us all these kids. And I love working with kids, which is, it seems like a lot of filmmakers don't like working with kids, but I just find kids are still in the world of make-believe and they can still just imagine that the thing that is supposed to be happening in the film is really happening. So I find it really easy to work with them. And Ada and Holden were just amazing. They're so natural. They don't look over the top when they're making things up. They just seem like it's really happening to them. So we found we had about three people we were thinking of for Ada's character, which is Zoe, and they were all very good. And we had them come in, and I had Ada do it because she's got a lot of strength to her, and Zoe's a very strong character. Ada's so good at not giving in to anyone. You know, she doesn't let anyone boss her around, and we needed someone tough like that. And then as far as Holden, who plays Francis, Zoe's little sidekick, he came in and I asked him to imitate a werewolf, and he did a werewolf imitation, and I immediately canceled all the remaining auditions for that role because he was just perfect.
In terms of directing a child on screen, especially when you've got a film like this where there's a lot of, you know, different stuff going on, there's, you know, they're witnessing romance, there's a lot of, you know, blood that Zoe or that Ada had to cover herself with, there's the stunt scene off the roof at the end. How do you go about working with the kids in those specific scenes?
So you have to be careful. You don't want to obviously injure a child, and you don't want to scare anyone, and you don't want to get arrested. So we're very careful about, you know, checking what are the rules when you work with child actors and how do we make the film set a safe place. And for the dangerous scenes, we had a stunt coordinator. So the scene where the kids are sitting on the roof and the scene where they jump off the roof, we had well, for the scene where they jump off the roof, we had our stunt coordinator built a platform. So they're actually, she only jumps about 3 feet, but it looks like she's jumping off the roof. And we also had them strapped to the roof, which ended up being so annoying in the editing process because you could see the cords tied around the kids and the camera's moving and the kids are moving, so the cords are moving. So it was a big pain to get those out, but thank goodness for really talented post-production people.
There's a couple of scenes where you are essentially directing someone who is directing. Did it start to feel maybe a little meta for you?
Yeah, a little bit. but I had Ada, sometimes when I was directing, I would have Ada come and she would call the shots. Like, I would say, all right, it's time to say action. And she'd call out action. And it, yeah, it felt a little bit weird, but it was fun. And it was fun to see her kind of develop an interest in directing as she went through that role.
Do you have a favorite memory from shooting, whether it was a scene or, you know, something that happened off camera or behind the scenes that you really enjoyed?
Oh gosh, there are so many great memories and so many memories that I just never want to think about again. I think most of directing for me is a little bit miserable because it's always, there's so many disasters that happen every day and you're just always like soaked in sweat and just exhausted and you don't know how you're going to get anything made. So there are a lot of bad memories, and yet they're still really good memories. And as time goes on, the hard part wears away and you just remember the funny parts. But one really good part for me was when we shot the car scenes. So we shot all the scenes that happen in Sal's truck on the same day. And me and the sound recorder, we couldn't find a way to get into the truck without being seen, so we ended up lying down flat in the truck bed, and we had all our equipment kind of wires wrapped around and going to all our equipment, so it was so strange, but it was so enjoyable. And then I just spent the whole rest of the day lying flat in this truck bed. I didn't even have to move. And I had a little screen set up in front of my face, and I would just direct from the screen. It was so relaxing. And Portland was so beautiful, and all the trees were passing by. So I enjoyed that. Although, unfortunately, we didn't get pulled over by the cops.
Just quickly on that note, I wanted to pick up, you know, Portland does have a very, in sort of the whole West Coast, has a very unique landscape. Did that become not a character, but did that become part of the film in any way for you?
Yeah, I think so. It's one of the biggest things I missed when I was working in LA is nature. I really missed having trees around other than palm trees, and you know, having a blue unpolluted sky. And Portland, you can't shoot an outdoor scene here without capturing some. We just have gorgeous trees, and we're right by Forest Park, and I mean, we have eagles coming out of the forest and circling around in my backyard, and it's just so beautiful. And it's really nice to see that in the outdoor scenes.
And finally, I wanted to ask, I know you've got your own production company, and you talk about sort of the stepping away from typical Hollywood plots. And I know one of your goals is to increase the representation of women in film. And there's a lot of talk about now with the, I think it's the 4% pledge and women writers and directors and producers, and we had Rachel Morrison nominated for cinematography. Where are we now, you know, with what we've seen in the last couple of years with that conversation and a greater representation of women in these projects? Where do you think we are, and where do you think we need to go?
Just the fact that we're having the conversation is huge progress to me. Obviously, I think we need to go a lot farther. My experience working in LA, I didn't experience so much intentional, blatant sexism. It's not like guys were saying, oh, you're a woman, so you can't work on our set. But the problem is that all of the power positions are just saturated with men, and usually white men. And as a storyteller, when I write screenplays and pitch them, just, I don't think intentionally, but because people gravitate towards characters they identify with, my stories about men were much, much more successful, and I couldn't get funding for my stories with women. And actually, my Zilla and Zoe, I wrote two different scripts. They were pretty much the same stories, and the one I produced is the one I wanted to tell. But the other script, the little kid who was making a horror film out of the sister's wedding, was a little boy. And the wedding was not between two women. It was a heterosexual wedding. And when I submitted that to producers, who are always male, it was much, much more popular than the other version, even though I think the other version is much more interesting. And I also submitted both screenplays to two major screenwriting contests, and the one with the men, with the heterosexual wedding and the male kid, placed well in both contests, and the one with the women did not place at all. And it's just, I experienced that a lot. And so I don't think it's intentional, but I think until we have people producing films, until we have women behind the scenes as producers and as the gatekeepers of contests and film festivals, I think we're going to see a huge bias towards films about men. And I think it should be more equal.
Well, this film definitely contributes to that. It's a fantastic film, Zilla and Zoe. Jessica Scalise, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you.
Alrighty, have a good day. Cheers.
You too. Bye-bye.
And that was my conversation with filmmaker Jessica Scalise. Her film, Zilla and Zoe, opens in theaters on Friday. That about does it for me today. My thanks to Ash Mayfair and Jessica Scalise. My guest this Sunday will be Toronto vocalist Corin Thomas Smith. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.